Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at PACUnderground.
In places like Sri Lanka, where some elephants are free to roam around the edge of the ocean, that just for the pure joy of it, they jump into the sea and they use their trunks as a snorkel. And they can go 20 to 30 miles just for the pleasure of it all.
You were just listening to Ingrid Newkirk, founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or as most of us know it, PETA. You can hear the rest of her interview with me on Voices for the Animals on Friday, February 28th, 10 a.m. right here on KBOO. Or go to kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals to listen online.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m. Coming up is we get an encore broadcast of Pacific Underground's conversation with an artist whose name I have trouble with. So I will just play the audio and let you hear it. Let you hear them say their own name for themselves, because that's what it's all about. Giving folks a microphone and letting them speak for themselves. And that's what you and a whole bunch of your friends and neighbors stepped up to support during our recent little mini drive. Thank you. Make sure to mail that check when the bill arrives. If that's what you chose to do. Make sure to follow through on telling your bank to give KBOO that $5, $10, $15, $12, or $11.50 a month on your behalf. That's right. Now for the program.
You're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Pacific Underground is currently on hiatus, so what you're hearing is going to be a rerun from February of 2019. Good morning. You're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Radio. I'm Sarah, your host, and today fellow member Jake and I are joined by artist Yukio Kawano. Yukio Kawano is a third-generation hibakusha, atomic bomb survivor, who grew up decades after the bombing of Hiroshima. Her work is personal, reflecting lasting attitudes toward the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Kawano received her MFA from Vermont College of Fine Art in 2012. Kawano has also given lectures at Aspen Institute in Tokyo, Portland State University, Portland, Oregon, Whitman College, Walla Walla, Washington, Bowdoin College, Brunswick, Maine, among many others, and also appeared in radio shows. Since 2016, Kawano's project, Suspended Moment, is selected by New York Foundation of the Arts fiscal sponsorship. Kawano is currently living in Portland, Oregon. Great, so that's a little bit about her, and without further ado, let's get into the interview.
So Sarah and I are really excited to host Yuki. We'd known of her work. I met her a year ago, or a little over a year ago, through our mutual friend Allison Cobb. We got a little bit of the bare bones from the bio, but tell us a little bit about your background. You didn't grow up in the U.S., right?
Right. I came to Portland 2001, February 2001, so just before 9/11.
Oh, wow.
From Hiroshima, Japan. So Portland is my, first time experiencing America and the culture and everything.
Yeah, and that was after high school, right? You were in college. You'd finished college in Japan and moved here as an artist.
Yeah, I was already working in Hiroshima.
Oh.
So I was in my mid-20s and I came here.
Yeah, that must have been a little bit of a culture shock.
Yes.
To come to Portland. It's not a very big city. It's smaller than Hiroshima, right? Is Hiroshima a bigger city?
It's the population is about the same, but Japanese city are more compact.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Portland. Portland is more spread out. The change.
Yeah. So growing up, did you hear many stories from your grandmother about the tragedy, or was it something that just everybody knew about but wasn't talked about very often?
Right. So it's, I think it's kind of similar in a lot of communities who experience the tragedy.
The trauma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like you're not so special. Like you're not the only person who suffer the atrocity. So whatever the story that you have, you kind of take it in and think that it's happened to everybody in a specific city.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you don't really talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And was there a sense of just sort of like being grateful that you survived and just move forward, don't think about the past?
Right.
Just think about the future, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the survival mechanism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, if you are the first generation of survivor, you just have to think about how to survive.
Right.
Which is happening to a lot of community or the nations in this very moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious. So three of my grandparents were in the internment camps here in the U.S. during World War II. Mm-hmm. And like the Japanese American community has this whole, shikata ga nai, gaman shiro kind of mentality, which is, we just have to be resilient and move on type of a thing. Was there some of that sort of mentality in Japan as well?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was?
There is a strong mentality. And because of the history of Japanese as a perpetrator,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So and my grandfather who was a hibakusha,
mm-hmm.
Went to the war in China too. He was in the midst of the atrocity was happening in China, and so shikata ga nai is very much there,
mm-hmm.
Like because we did it too to other people,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was like something like really strong in our community or in our family. So I grew up in it.
That's interesting. Yeah, that makes it really kind of complex.
Yeah,
and nuanced. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very complicated. Those feelings of like shame, that
right.
And guilt that
yeah.
sort of like prevent you from dealing with your own victimhood, your own pain, mm-hmm. and so it's left to the later generations to try to separate that and.
Tie it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just make sense of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me what the literal translation of the Japanese phrase that you mentioned was?
Oh, shikata ga nai?
Mm-hmm.
Shikata ga nai.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I think it's kind of nuanced because I don't know if there's like a direct translation, mm-hmm. especially like in the mentality of it.
Perseverance,
but,
maybe?
Yeah, perseverance and like just like it can't be helped sort of a thing. Yeah, I think that's probably the best translation of it.
Yeah, just sort of a fatalistic, you know, like that's, yeah.
And it's definitely a survival mechanism for sure, mm-hmm. coping mechanism. And it's, I mean, it's interesting in the community here because the more recent generations have been trying to sort of not just like discard that, but like try to realize that it doesn't necessarily fit us anymore. And because those kind of mentalities prevented us from speaking out mm-hmm. as much in the past. And so we're trying to break down those mentalities now and say, you know, it might have been a great coping mechanism before, but it doesn't necessarily serve us now. So I was just curious if it was similar in Japan because I, you know, sort of assumed like that's where the Japanese Americans got that mm-hmm. sort of culture and mentality.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I talked to my collaborator for the Children Remember Project, Chisao Hata, and we talk about Shikashaganai a lot, how it, you know, come about. I mean, how Japanese American translated it, and it's still like really in that culture. Yeah.
Really ingrained, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you was your grandmother was a dressmaker, and
mm-hmm. she was a kimono maker.
Owned a shop, like.
No, she's just
shop, or just independent.
Mm-hmm. At home, back in days, a lot of women are doing that, because it's all handmade. Yeah. Mm. So my grandma was one of them. Taking you know, more like a personal order from the little village. Mm-hmm. That somebody wants new kimono, and mm-hmm. she sew it for them.
Oh, that's good. So that sort of kind of helped evolve your own art practice using fabrics.
Yeah. So. It's during my MFA program, actually. So I went to Vermont College of Fine Arts. And I actually went there as a two-dimensional painter.
Oh,
cool.
Oil painter. And it was kind of the skill that I was... I know that I have that skill. So that was the thing that I can bring to my MFA.
Right. Did you always used to draw as a kid?
Right. Mm-hmm. So I know that I'm good at it. And I know that that's how... I was believing that that's how I got my MFA. I entered my MFA program. Mm-hmm. And then as the semester goes, my... faculty members and the artist teacher and advisor or studies to ask me, like, you have a very specific message. Do you think mm-hmm. Your material, the things that you use to express your voice is really speaking your voice?
So you had to re-examine what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
How did you start? How did you evolve into fabrics?
Well, so I was pretty in a confusing, kind of sad place. And I was like, started to read Dalida and deconstruction and all that stuff. And
postmodern stuff.
So. Yeah, I was really confused, and that's pretty much what MFA does that to you.
Makes you question stuff.
Yeah, wow. Like change your perception, I guess.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I had to really think about it, and I was in my bedroom, and I just saw this grandma's kimono hanging. And I was just, you know, in this pretty dark place, I said, I just want to disassemble grandma's kimono.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
deconstruct everything.
So, yeah, that was the time that idea of using kimono came about.
Oh, wow, that's beautiful, yeah. So I love some of your art pieces.
Yeah, that I learned that it's really important in making art. Like the process and also editing is really, really crucial. Yeah. And my, I was really lucky. I had Roger Shimomura as my artist teacher. Because it's a law residency program, so I can choose my artist teacher or mentor.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, whoever I want and whoever I can meet and talk during the semester.
And I'm not too familiar with Roger's work. What's sort of like his main aesthetic?
So he's a first generation internment camp survivor. Mm. He spent his childhood, like, I think he was 4 when he was interned. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so his subject, I mean, he's a painter, but he tapped into that time and the subject over and over and over.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty important strong stuff.
And he also put himself in the work, too, and... Yeah, he has way to find or juxtaposing the images, which is unexpected. So when you see his painting, a lot of time when you see his painting, you go like, what's going on? And so that painting will invite people to come closer. And then they'll realize what they are seeing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And force you to sort of question and recontextualize a lot of things. So his mentorship really helped you turn the corner and gain better understanding.
Yes. Like what does it mean to, like how, why am I making art? Like what is the reason and what can be edited out? And I did this exercise creating haikus with him too. And so he taught me how to simplify sentences or the art piece is actually making it oftentimes stronger.
Boiling down something to a more kind of core essence. That's powerful, yeah. Was it writing haikus in English or Japanese?
We did both, but Roger don't speak Japanese, so
So for him it was English, but had you written them as in Japanese growing up? Was that part of the regular kind of education back home? That's what I figured.
Yeah. So, like, simple words have a lot of potential. We can use difficult words, but those complicated words don't really give you that much options. Using the simple words actually, it's a good tool to suggest something while you're not very specific about something.
And you were able to then sort of like translate that to your art pieces?
I think so.
When did you get the idea for the suspended moment kind of exhibition that you did?
So my art piece kind of removed from the wall, right? So now it's in a three-dimensional space as an object. And that's when I felt the impact of the space surrounding it mm-hmm. is all like part of the artwork. Mm-hmm. And it's activating. It's like because of the art object, the space is no longer the space that wasn't activated.
Oh, right.
So suddenly there mm-hmm. is this performative element.
Hmm. Right, there's a change.
Yeah.
Change
yeah.
of state kind of thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's
and that was Roger too.
That's fascinating.
Like, okay, it's a performance piece.
Yeah.
And I you know, I was a two-dimensional, you know, artist, and I'm like really typical artist who wants to stay inside
right.
all the
shy
time.
Of kind
right.
of venturing out.
Yeah, I don't want to mm-hmm. like really share.
Right. You're in your medium. You're safe there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that, you know, safe feeling.
Security, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, so it was a total shock for me. But yeah, Roger made a lot of performance piece too.
Oh, okay.
Actually, one of his, I think all the students are publishing the book about his performance piece.
Oh, cool.
Oh,
and
wow.
It should be coming out this year, maybe next year. But yeah, so he has this background of, you know, how performance art can be used. Like his subject is really specific. And my subject is, you know, quite specific as well. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. he was like, yeah, helping me to use this tool, mm-hmm. performance.
Mm-hmm. The engagement with the piece becomes the performance.
Yeah.
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 Oh, wow. That's really cool.
So, yeah, slowly, Roger was like pushing me to
yeah.
that direction.
Okay.
And then, like, at the end of the MFA program, after 2 years, I had already this idea of combining Buto and...
Yeah, yeah. I was actually curious how you thought, you know, initially of, like, incorporating the Buto dance with your artwork.
I think it was something that I was, that kind of image was already there. So probably growing up in mm-hmm. Japan, I guess I sort of had that image. And I met Buto dancer Mishi in 2014 or 2013. And yeah, I already know that this is the dance that I want
mm-hmm.
to have with my piece. And Mishi felt the same way, so that's how we are still working on. He's actually coming to my residency.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it continues, and I also... So I'm taking Mishi's Buto class
mm-hmm.
Every week. And I feel like Buto helps people to be more, to have empathy. Because you understand your original body more. So there is like a different level in the class to understand each other. Like, in our daily life, you understand other using your head.
Mm-hmm.
But in Buto class, it's the process of finding the original body.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a different way of understanding the person who are dancing with you.
For listeners who might not be that knowledgeable about what Buto is, could you give a little bit of a description and maybe a little mm-hmm. bit of its history as well?
So Buto emerged after the war, Second mm-hmm. World War II. Second World War.
It's a recent art form.
Yeah, it's a contemporary art. And it emerged within that culture, like everything is destroyed. And it emerged out of ash, right?
Yeah, wow.
So they had to question what is these dance form that they were taught when they are young, like these European art form.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to have this like original dance that is different from the dance that they learned mm-hmm. growing up. And they have to like really dig in and see from within like who they are and how their body
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Works. Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Was it a sense that the Eurocentric art forms were tied up with militaristic pre-war mm. kind of culture and they wanted to go back to?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Maybe.
A different time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not too familiar with, you know, like modernism as a movement, you know, in Japan. And I only know of like a couple poets that worked kind of like translated into Japanese a lot of European poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, you know, died young, and a lot of the survivors were caught up in trying to avoid getting purged or like by the government. And so they mm-hmm. kind of went along with the dominant culture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them were discredited because of that, and maybe European dance forms were similar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just thinking about, so after the Edo period, so Japan had to face this, you know, they had to open the country
mm-hmm.
by the pressure, Western power and all that. So they had to westernize
right.
The whole nation. And yeah, so during the Meiji and Taisho, there were a lot of art form and all the, yeah, everything needs to be updated mm-hmm. up to the standard. So mm-hmm. yeah, it was like really encouraged for people, young people from all different Virginia to
mm-hmm.
you know, oftentimes go to America and go to mm-hmm. European country to study.
I see. So yeah, I could see how kind of reclaiming the original body mm-hmm. is a kind of healing, very sort of like healing way to deal with the trauma.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine after it feels like your country's just been like defeated and devastated, you need something that feels like a rebirth. Right, mm-hmm. like a grounding type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're tuned in to Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. As a reminder, Pacific Underground is currently on hiatus, and if you would like to become a member, we are searching for more new members. There will be information on how to contact us at the end of the episode. You are currently listening to a rerun episode from February of 2019.
Yeah, so could you tell us a little bit about the little boy model that's in your piece?
So little boy is the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. In August 6, 1945. And I made replica of little boy using my grandma's kimono, and I stitched them together with my hair.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a third generation Hibakusha, which means my grandfather was the grandparents is the Hibakusha, which means that hibaku means radiation affected people. So that means that there is this ongoing study or you know, ongoing speculation about genetic mutation, genetic problems, mm-hmm. or genetic
right.
you know, affected by DNA, affected by the radiation, right?
Carrying down, right?
Mm-hmm. So
epigenetic trauma, I think they call it, something
yeah.
like that, but maybe radiation specific.
Yeah, radiation is more like a direct mm-hmm. effect.
Because you get like actual genetic birth defects and things, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that's interesting, is to, you know, use my hair as a third generation, because it goes down to generation. If you know, if your DNA mm-hmm. is damaged, mm-hmm. it goes down to the generation, and that's what people fear about radiation in mm-hmm. general, right?
Yeah.
Right,
so,
yeah.
I thought it's a good tool to use, and because it's my grandma's kimono and my grandma, you know, touched it and you know, hand stitched it. So there is this juxtaposition of like skin and you know, my hair as a hibakusha. So yeah, as using these materials, I was in this place that I can talk about history of Hiroshima, and then this little boy image kind of emerged. So I decided to make the the symbolic
mm-hmm. yeah.
image.
Because it's also your grandmother's DNA in the hair also, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of the bomb is like really heavy metal right. object, but by using, instead of metal, kimono and fabric and mm-hmm. hair, it's a soft sculpture.
Right. Yeah.
So there is this juxtaposition mm-hmm. or the kind of comparing in a challenging way how mm-hmm. I deal with this symbolic image.
Yeah, because it's hard to talk about directly, but if you have a piece of art that, you know, and especially one that, because I think of clothes as something that, like, you know, is almost necessary for life, mm-hmm. you know, it shelters us. And so something that's like almost like life-giving as compared to, you know, something that brings death. And so, like, I found that very powerful.
Yeah, so that's the other part. Like, when we were, we think about war, you know, using books and materials, we don't really talk about the individual, you know, people and victims. And so this piece kind of, in a way, suggesting or helping people to bring it down to human scale.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, you know, when American people talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the image that they have is this mushroom
cloud, yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, but for people from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we were under the mushroom cloud, so mm-hmm. that's really not the, you know, people who were there, they didn't see mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were yeah. in it.
Yeah.
So the image is totally different.
It's dehumanizing.
It
yeah,
is,
yeah.
Absolutely.
To look at it from up
yeah.
above.
Mm-hmm.
It takes it away from, you know, many of the real effects. You know, it's an abstraction almost.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that was,
you know,
kind of purposeful though too, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I went to high school here, and we, like, very briefly learned about it. And it was just kind of amazing how, like you said, like, it's not humanizing at all. It's just thought of as an event, and then honestly, it's almost like the more people die, the less the individual people matter. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And there were tons of people in my class who, when we talked about it, were like, yeah, it was necessary, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It was, I mean, I had a bachan, a grandmother, who was in Japan during that time. She wasn't, you know, hibakusha, so she wasn't, like, directly affected by the atom bombs, but she, you know, was, like, running away from other bombs that were being dropped and things like that. And so in high school, when I was learning about that and also just, like, learning about the American perception of it,
mm-hmm.
it was, like, a very traumatizing thing. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, how was it for you coming to America and sort of, like, seeing how Americans perceived it and, like, putting your work out there to an American audience?
Well, I kind of already knew, and also, as we talked about Shikataganai,
mm-hmm.
that was the mentality that I grew up
mm-hmm.
with. So, a lot of people in Hiroshima believes, like second generation and third generation, think that it was necessary too,
mm-hmm.
and that was the education that mm-hmm. we had.
That's interesting that it was also over there too.
Mm-hmm. Well, so yeah. after the Second World War, what I believe is that Japan was not fully independent nation. And it was like a sub-nation of the United States because of the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, American militarization is like really existing as we speak.
Yes, absolutely.
In that land.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And being an occupied people, mm-hmm. it's hard to really like be objective about history when
right.
you have
somebody
a lot of military still there to this day.
Somebody else is writing it for you, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's, as we speak, it's still going. Like Japanese government don't talk about issues and subjects that American government don't want to talk about.
Mm.
So if America encourage people to teach that way about the atomic bomb, you know, naturally or obviously, I think that's what the education system like say, okay,
mm-hmm.
shikata ga nai. That's
mm-hmm.
how that's how mm-hmm. we teach our kids.
Yeah. And I think also the education also was affected some by the occupying, you know, people. I read about how MacArthur was treated when,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was almost like a king or something just below the emperor
mm-hmm.
in Japan. It's just like as you know, people were trying to survive and were very traumatized. Like, it was a coping mechanism,
mm-hmm.
like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So, could you tell us a little bit about the Children Remember Project? Because that's sort of, you know, within that culture of kind of like survival mentality, there's still, you know, efforts by, you know, some of the teachers that, was it your old high school in
mm-hmm.
Hiroshima to remember some of these narratives?
Yeah, so Children Remember is the project that is done by, well, the organization who initiated the project is Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. So they were trying to find the partnership with the local school. So they actually tried the Hiroshima City University first.
Mm-hmm.
But after a couple of years, they decided to partner with Motomachi High School, which is the school I went. And also one of the school who actually have a like art curriculum. So it's a very unique school.
Mm.
And so it started 2007 And what they do is
they have after you've already moved here.
Yeah.
After you are in the U.S., mm-hmm. but you heard about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, I guess I was like looking at Twitter or something, and mm-hmm. that just, you know, oh, pops wow. up about the Motomachi High School student, Genbaku no e, which means the drawing of the atomic bomb mm-hmm. Atrocity. So yeah, it was a coincidence that I just looked at it and yeah, learned about this project that is happening now. And it was last year I had a chance to go back to Hiroshima, and I contacted the school, and the teacher who are in charge of the project, he invited me over and we had an interview. And he also invited three of the students who were undergoing the Children Remember. Wow. So yeah, I had a chance to talk to them and talk about their process. So it's a 1 year long project. After the initial meeting, which each student are assigned to finish one painting after the year, and they are kind of assigned to the specific site that they are going to paint to. Mm-hmm. So each student partner with Hibakusha, a first generation atomic bomb survivor, and they'll hear the story from the survivor.
Okay.
And after that, it's up to each student mm-hmm. to go back to the Hibakusha and show their sketch, mm-hmm. and then the narrative or the dialogue starts. And it's just incredible project that high school student, mm-hmm. you know, 16, 17 years old, are going to Hibakusha who are, you know, at least in their 80s or late 80s, and some of them are 90,
yeah.
in their 90s, and talk about the memories that each Hibakusha has. And I was just asking a bunch of questions to these students, and yeah, I was just so moved by their power of imagination.
Mm.
And I was, yeah, I felt really hopeful. Like it's so kind of different from just listening the testimony, because the student actually have to visualize it, mm-hmm. right? So in order to do that, they have different process. The brain go through different process to make this scene. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I felt like this is like secondhand witness. Like they are more close to like actually witnessing the scene. So it's
yeah.
like really traumatized event for these, you know, mm-hmm. young students. Mm-hmm. But so impactful.
Yeah.
And they were so, yeah, the power of imagination also their sympathy, and they're more feel like they're more sensitive, and like they have more receiving power.
Mm.
And I feel like this is kind of project that can be applied to so many different communities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I took all this concept back to Chisao, mm-hmm. back to Portland, and Chisao said, okay, we can do some kind of community event
mm-hmm.
That is suggesting more like the experience of Children Remember than
right.
just exhibition. Mm-hmm. So we made this poetic text and perform.
Yeah.
The text.
Like a choral poem. Yeah.
So we were thinking, we actually did the last one a couple weeks ago. So.
Oh.
Yeah, we've been doing it 3 times already, and we were thinking, like, this might be something that we can continue going.
That's great.
And involving different communities to join us as well. So there is a potential for children to remember.
Yeah, there's something powerful about sort of like receiving that or sharing, you know, sharing the story so that the survivor doesn't have to go through it alone. There was something really powerful that you mentioned that one of the Hibakusha said to you about how they felt when they shared it with the student and like kind of like left the story with them. Do you remember what that was?
Well, it's Giselle was suggesting that last time that we were meeting, like this piece is like really important for high school students, but it's also important for Hibakusha. It's such a healing process for Hibakusha to talk to, you know, someone younger than their grandchildren, maybe. And I mean, it's a different level of being hard, right? Because the image, I mean, the memory was translated into this
image
work of art.
Yeah, and they had to go back a couple times. You mentioned like one of the artists said their Hibakusha said there's like to add more bodies or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Wow. It's like my gosh.
Yeah. So after the initial meeting they go back with their sketchbook, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when their dialogue starts and Hibakusha have to be more specific and student has to be more specific about, you know, what color should I apply on this, you know, human skin or something pretty, you know, grotesque and really hard for high school students to deal with. But that's what they talk during the course. And one of the students told me that she has gone back to her Hibakusha 10 times.
Ten times.
And also talk on the phone too. So it's quite a project.
That's amazing. I'm glad that exists out there. And I'm glad that you and Chisao have been kind of like signal boosting and bringing attention to that.
And you're right, I think it could apply to a lot of communities. You know, it's not just like a one-sided thing of like the Hibakusha saying something to the student just doing it. It's like so much of a give and take, right?
Yeah, I've heard of that also when they've set up students with like in interviews with people, students in the Philippines, with people who were tortured during the dictatorship. And like, oh, martial law wasn't that bad at first, the students are saying, because there's a lot of silencing in our communities and a lot of miseducation. And then little by little, the interviewee reveals, oh, yeah, you know, they taped me to a car battery or something grotesque. And like all these sort of stories. And, you know, you see the student, like, there's a change. They're really affected. And a lot of times, because of the trauma, they're crying too. And, you know, I've heard of, people who have interviewed, you know, other sort of like World War II survivors or something like that. And, you know, concentration camp survivors. It's like, it's so necessary and so powerful to like not isolate these stories and let them die because the elders, you know, they're getting older.
That's the part. Like Children Remember Project is probably not gonna last. Like it won't go on another 10 years for sure.
Because of the Hibakusha generation.
So that's the reality that we have too.
Yeah. It's almost a race against time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about your collaboration with Allison Cobb, mm-hmm. poet?
So Allison actually from Los Alamos, New Mexico. She lives in Portland, Oregon now, but she grew up in Los Alamos and had father is a scientist, mm-hmm. and he worked.
And Los Alamos is where the research for all the mm-hmm. atomic bombs and everything was performed. So it was a very big facility mm-hmm. in that Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is the city that little boy which dropped on Hiroshima and fat man dropped on Nagasaki were built.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we met through a mutual friend, and we started kind of slowly started talking.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we have a lot of common and a lot of things that there are this deeper understanding of the history, even if we are from the, you know, opposite end,
mm-hmm.
right? But in a way that helps us to see the event differently from mm-hmm. the other people, because it's right. so personal for us.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we were feeling encouraged to talk deeper about how we see the history and mm-hmm. how we feel affected by it. And I invited her to be in this, to be in a performance piece, Suspended a Moment. And Arson started taking the Butoh class.
Mm-hmm.
And then she, I think it was Mishi, Arson, and I, and also sound person Lisa, while we are talking Suspended a Moment, Arson said, that's when I think she wrote a poem.
Mm-hmm.
called We Must Look.
Okay.
And this poem is based on 2016 Obama visit to Hiroshima.
Okay.
And that
I think I heard that poem.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, first the sitting president visiting Hiroshima.
So she took his words, right, from mm-hmm. the speech?
Mm-hmm. So that's it was cool. a significant event, but the... yeah, and she took Obama's speech that he made in Hiroshima in 2016 mm-hmm. and used it as a kind of deconstruct
mm-hmm.
the piece and make it in a way that we think it shift our perspective or way of understanding of what he's actually saying.
Right.
Yeah. That was a really neat piece. I remember that.
So Arison suggested to me to translate the poem. So mm-hmm. There is this component of English and Japanese.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
and so now this poem is like part of is English, Arison's voice and my voice sort of echoing the translation.
Mm-hmm.
of what it was, what it said.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And then you got to perform that in Los Alamos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. took a trip to the, you know, one of the reactor sites or something in Hanford, right?
Yeah. So Los Alamos, we took the piece to the place called Hua Lodge, and that's where the, you know, during the Manhattan Project, mm-hmm. or the scientists were, it's a like community place that they had social activities
mm-hmm. oh, wow.
happen in that place.
So are there any other projects you have coming up besides your residency in this that you'd like to promote?
In my art residency, I am trying to project my work to the Pueblos.
Mm.
And like what I am intending to do is I want to have start building the relationship with the Pueblo communities and
mm-hmm.
and well, people who are affected by this, you know, nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm. Because they're the people that originally owned the land that Los Alamos was taken from.
Mm-hmm.
And also the people who are probably affected the most by the nuclear contamination that's
right.
there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's always, you know, the indigenous population
yeah.
is always the people who get
yeah.
most affected.
Yeah.
And I was interested in this because the more I understand Hanford,
mm-hmm.
I find out about Yakama Nation and
yeah.
Colombia, mm-hmm. you know, the dam project.
Yeah, like the sacred mountain that they won't give back, that's like on the Hanford
mm-hmm.
reservation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a spiritual place. And yeah, it's just even in Portland's backyard, right, on the Columbia River.
Yes.
It's so tragic.
Mm-hmm. And I had a chance to talk to Alfred Peter from mm. Yakama Nation, like late December. And yeah, she's educating the nation, Yakama Nation, what Hanford means to them.
Right.
Before
yeah.
Hanford.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she taught me how sacred land was and
right.
how
mm-hmm.
how we need to find, I mean, see the land as not like contaminated land, but that was the
mm-hmm.
land once it was loved and
mm.
taken care of
mm-hmm.
right.
throughout the generation.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there
powerful.
Is spirit and there is God in that land. And, you know, that was kind of washed out or, you know, brutally destroyed or...
Mm-hmm.
We were made to not to feel it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that we're not think of the land as a part of us.
Right.
Right. It's think of us as separate.
And especially contaminated land too. It's just like, oh, you know, just discard it. It's like useless. It's
mm-hmm.
there's nothing
mm-hmm.
growing in it anymore or whatever.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Land. That's something that we use.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Or like own,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
of like settler, you know,
yeah.
settler states.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Native American has totally different, you know, way of understanding the land, understanding Hanford,
right.
understanding Los Alamos.
Different value system,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Which I am really intrigued by, so... That's something that I'm like really aiming
oh,
to
that's
do.
Great that's that you're
awesome.
Able to
yeah.
connect with the actual nations that like wow, well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I hope you have a great residency. And
mm-hmm.
is there any other artists or like people, you know, like recommend to us on the show?
Yeah, you just talked about Kathy briefly. Yeah,
oh,
she's
yeah.
like really important.
Yeah.
In our community.
Kathy Gentle Kitchener, like we're hoping to have her on the show
mm-hmm.
eventually. If you're listening, Kathy, you're probably not, but get in touch. Just kidding. And Chisao, your collaborator,
mm-hmm.
Chisao Ata, and Allison Cobb,
mm-hmm.
both friends of the show.
Yep.
Yeah. Anybody else you can think of?
Not at the moment.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming
yeah,
to join
thank
us,
you
Yuki.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
we had
it was
a great
really
time.
Meaningful
chatting
discussion
with you.
For me too.
And You've been listening to Pacific Underground. I'm Jake with Yuki and Sarah.
Yep.
So thanks for listening.
Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word, or message us on Instagram at PAC Underground.